the studios of Central Coast Public Radio KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest is Max Allen Collins. Max Allen Collins is the author of like 9 million books, comics, and graphic novels, including The Road to Perdition. His latest book is published by Hard Case Crime, and it is set in the world of the 1950s comic book scandals. It's called Seduction of the Innocent. Max Allen Collins, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you for having me.
So your novel is set in the world of comics, a world you know well.
Yes, it's a world a little bit before my time. I was a kid, little kid, when this stuff was going on, and I think that whole era where comic books came under fire and there was a McCarthy-era witch hunt against the comic books, which sounds crazy now, but was absolutely the case, that's something that's kind of informed my enthusiasm and view of comics from the beginning, because some of my favorite comic books when I was like 6 or 7 years old got taken away from me, basically, by not by my parents, but by the marketplace.
Well, David Haydu was here on the show, and you mentioned his book.
Yes.
The 10-Cent Plague, which is a great book. And your book is kind of a fictional version of that book, so to speak.
Yeah, that was one of my main references, although there were quite a few others. And I work with a guy named George Hagenauer. He's worked with me on all of my Nathan Heller historical thrillers and virtually all the historical stuff I've done. And he is really a scholar on the history of comics, and he worked. We had many conversations of brainstorming about just how to present this, and him sharing with me his voluminous knowledge about this period of American history and American comics history.
Well, I want to talk more about your Seduction of the Innocent and also Frederick Wertheim's, but I also want to ask you about your comic book work. I mean, you started...
Sure.
I miss Wild Dog, by the way. He was one of my
Thank you.
I believe Wild Dog is the only superhero not to be in New York or...
That's right. I feel like, you know, it's sort of a cultish thing. Some people know about it, but I feel like we were really the predecessor to Kick-Ass. You know, we were the first homemade superhero where somebody in the real world said, I'm going to be a superhero.
Yeah. And he wore, for those of you who don't know, he wore a hockey mask, I think.
Right.
And he wore his high school jersey that had...
Right. Yeah, it was... originally, it was going to be actually called Red Dog. Because... it's a football term, you know, for, you know, charging the line. And but there was an obscure Marvel character, I think, called Red Dog, so we had to change it.
And recently, Wild Dog did show up. I saw a picture. He was on a poster of one of the Crisis on the Infinite Earth.
Yeah, it'd be fun to do him again.
But so you, let's go back to Dick Tracy. Was that your first foray into comics?
Yes, essentially. I had a friend who's actually a pretty well-known guy in comics sort of scholarship, a guy named Rick Marshall, who at the time was the president of the Chicago Sun-Times syndicate. And he and I were friends. We were swapping original comic art. And he lived in Geneva, Illinois. I live in Muscatine, Iowa. And we would get together. And he invited me to try out, to develop a new detective strip for that syndicate. And I actually put something together called Heaven and Heller, which was where my Nathan Heller character first appeared. And it was sold to the Chicago Sun-Times on a basis of, you know, 3 weeks of samples. And somewhere along the line, he lost his job, and 3 or 4 strips that he had bought were never put into production. And so I'd had that little taste of of thinking through what it would be like to do a daily strip and so on, and fooling a little bit with the form. And as it happened, Rick was in a position about a year later, two years later, to recommend me to the Chicago Tribune Syndicate, because an editor there called him and said, do you know anybody who could maybe do Dick Tracy? And Rick recommended me.
And was Chester Gould still living then?
Yes, he was. I knew Chet, actually. A lot of people kind of assumed that Chet put that in motion for me, because we were friends. We had, after I sold my first novel in 1973, I got in touch with him, because he had been very kind to me when I was a kid, and it sent me a number of letters. And so I sort of got reacquainted with him, and he invited me out to his estate. His farm is in outside Woodstock, Illinois. And I would go in and have lunch with him in Chicago at a place called the Tavern Club, where a lot of newspaper people would go, and executives. And
well, that must have been fun.
Yeah, and we two or three times a year I would go have lunch with him, and he would tell me what was coming up in Dick Tracy. And then,
that was
oddly...
Like that was like in the science fiction era of Dick Tracy, where he was in space.
It was actually right after that. It was this was really toward the very end. He had gotten all the science fiction stuff essentially out. And when I had the, when I got the phone call to try out for the strip, and as I say, Rick Marshall happened to recommend me, and then just by coincidence, they also called my book agent and said, "Do you know anybody that could write Dick Tracy?" And he said my name, because I had written several books that had comics as a theme. There was a character in my early books who was a comic book fan. Back when there were hardly any comic book fans, at least on the radar of popular culture generally, San Diego Con was a twinkle in Schildorf's eye, I think, at that point. And so I think the fact that they talked to two or three people and they all mentioned this guy in Iowa, that I got the opportunity to try out for the strip and landed it. And about a week later, I got a phone call from Chester Gould saying, "I understand, congratulations are in order." And he was actually thrilled that it had stayed in the Midwest, because he didn't want one of those Hollywood or New York people to get it. And then I would say probably became an even closer friend of Chet's once I began doing the strip, because for the first, I think, 3 or 4 years, he was a consultant on the strip.
So you picked his brain.
Yeah, and I would really use him as a reference. He really was knowledgeable about the forensics and the police science, because he had taken a number of courses, and that was a big part of Dick Tracy.
Well, I read the Crime Stoppers, and that's how I got my...
Oh, yeah. A guy named Alvin Linus was the guy who wrote those for him.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Those are great. Well, that's an interesting form, especially in a daily, because you have to have... It's got to be enough that you want to keep reading, but there's got to be something satisfying that happens in the three panels that you could write every day.
Right, and the other tricky thing is that the Sunday page then had to encapsulate briefly what happened during the week, because there were three different ways the strip would be read, and I imagine this is still true for some of the story strips, what few are left. But you had some clients who ran it as a daily strip. You had some clients who ran it as a Sunday strip, and you had some clients that ran it 7 days. So you had to write it in such a way that it worked however you read it. And that's one of the aspects of writing a story strip that's always been true, except for King Features in some places where they did two different stories.
Right. So,
they do a story in the daily and a story in the Sunday. But that's a very tricky thing to do, to have it not seem incredibly redundant or seem like you can't tell what's going on because stuff has been left out.
And while you were writing Dick Tracy, you were always writing novels and stuff too?
Oh, yes. And Dick Tracy was, because it was lucrative and only took me about a day a week to do, because, of course, I did not draw it. I was the writer.
Right.
And that gave me the luxury of being able to explore some things. I spent, I think, a couple of years on my book, True Detective, which was the first of the historical novels. And that's really what kind of turned my career around, at least as a novelist.
And before we leave comics behind, we're chatting with Max Allen Collins. I remember a memorable run, brief but memorable run, you did on Batman.
Well, some people would like to forget it, I'm sure.
Oh, I loved it. It was great.
It was very controversial at the time, and it still is. You can go online and find people who despise me and despise my work based upon my about year I did of Batman.
Yeah.
And it was, in their defense, why I should be defending them, I don't know. It was a somewhat disastrous run, because I had a nice tryout with a terrific artist, and I did two issues, and then I got the job. In the meantime, the next thing that ran were, I think there were four issues or six issues or whatever of Batman Year One,
right,
which were phenomenal, and also were part of the whole Frank Miller Batman thing.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, Denny O'Neill contacted me and said he wanted me to do a reboot. And and he specifically had some things he wanted me to do with the Jason character. And so, and they had an artist whose name I also don't remember, who was lined up with, we were going to be this great team together. He did one issue and kind of flamed out, and I was probably three scripts ahead, and the next run of scripts all were done by different artists. And some of the artists didn't see the character designs of the other artists, and it was a mess.
A continuity mess, huh?
It was a continuity mess, and there was some, I thought, very heavy-handed editing done on my work. And I had a lot of, although I really respect Denny both as an editor and as a writer, he and I had some problems. You got to remember, this is the days before email, and so you maybe you talk a little bit on the phone, but you didn't have quite the direct line of communication that you can have now. And we ran into what I think was a weird problem where we respected each other, and that got in the way to where I was afraid to say things to him and he was afraid to say things to me. And so we kind of didn't ever connect the way we should have. Years later, I did a graphic novel for him, and it went extremely smoothly. But, you know, there were some things done. Like on the reboot, I had an opening caption that set it up as a reboot, and the caption was dropped. So everybody felt like I just sort of threw him into the middle of the pool.
Like you were just ignoring the history.
Yeah, and I had a very specific caption, and you know, things like that. There were some fun things about my short run, my short ignoble run. a thing I did where Robin, where Jason steals the wheels off the Batmobile, got into the cartoons. I think.
Oh, cool.
And,
do you get a residual or whatever?
No, I don't. You do get money when they reprint the stories.
Oh, that's good.
And I mean, I did a one story that Denny picked that was in a Penguin story I did that was in one of the world's greatest Batman collections. But generally speaking, it was kind of a mess. The happiest ending I had, speaking of royalties, is that Toys R Us came along to DC and said, we want to do, you know, we want to package half a dozen Batman comic books to sell at Toys R Us. And they came in and they read like 3 years of Batman, and they picked mine. They did.
Great.
All they did was pick mine. Now, people would argue and say, well, that's because they were childish. And so, of course, Toys R Us picked them. On the other hand, there was nothing childish about the royalty checks I got, which came for years.
Well, I remember your initial run on Batman being pretty complex, where you had a cop who thought he was Batman. And
yeah, that was the... Dennis Cowan is the guy who did that. Dennis Cowan was the artist. He's terrific.
Yeah, I like that storyline a lot. You also, I was introducing you saying you've written like 9 million books, but I mean, you probably have written so many. Do you know how many books you've actually written?
No, I think in excess of 100.
Well, and one of the things I love, and I know this is a sort of a thing that gets a bad rap, and that is a novelization, but you do something even more than novelizations, and novelization is kind of a stupid word, but that's the word.
Yeah,
but
it's a word we're sort of stuck with.
Yeah, where you make a novel of a movie that people have seen. But you do it with a lot of style.
Well, thanks.
And then you do that other thing where you take characters that we've seen in movies and television and expand them, prequel.
Yeah, I did 10 CSI novels, and we did 3 Criminal Minds and 3 Dark Angel. And
those Dark Angels are great. People who missed the series can go and read those books. And you did a prequel on NYPD Blue, I believe.
Yeah, I did 2 NYPD Blues, and one was a prequel. I've done that a couple times. I did a prequel on Dark Angel as well. It was kind of interesting on Dark Angel because I ended up doing a prequel to the series, and then the series got unexpectedly canceled. It was a weird situation where at the end of the second season, they were picked up and then unpicked up. And so we had the license, that Ballantyne, I think it was, had the license to do the books, and they came to me and said, can you basically end the series? And so I ended up doing because they'd had a cliffhanger episode. Mm-hmm. I ended up doing the second book is basically the first episode of the third season that never happened, where I resolve the cliffhanger from the season ending cliffhanger, and then the third book I essentially ended the series, at least the TV series, which had to do with a snake cult and everything. I'm leaving the door open that you could do more books, and that didn't happen. I think it was too bad, because I think that would have made a nice run of books, and there are a lot of Dark Angel fans out there.
Now, do you ever come up with an idea and, you know, you want to write it, but you can't because you don't, you know?
The licensing world is such that, and I know some people that are involved with licensing, by which I mean, you know, the characters created by somebody else, TV shows, movies, and so on. But when you're a licensing writer, what you really do is wait for the phone to ring, and somebody, you know, you don't sit around and say, boy, I'd love to write Star Trek, or write a Star Trek novel and send it in and say, maybe they'll publish it. You know, you got to wait for the call from the publisher that has the rights to Star Trek. That's how it works.
But are you a guy, Max Allen Collins, are you a guy that just has a gajillion stories and rambling around in your head and you can't wait to get them out, and then you just sit down at the typewriter, or the computer rather,
yep,
and it just flies out of you?
So there's a little bit of that, and a little bit of just, I mean, there's the whole area of here are some stories I'd like to write, and then there's the other area, which is how motivated I am to have some electricity to run the computer and to have the lights be on in my house. So, I mean, I am a working writer. I do not have another job. I'm not a teacher. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a writer. And when people talk to me about how prolific I am, I'm like, well, what am I supposed to do with my time? I mean, and I'm not so hugely successful that I can write one book and, you know, spend 3 months on it and then watch TV for the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to, you know, to write somewhere between 3 and 5 books a year, depending on what they are and what my schedule is like. And that's what I do.
And you also collaborate with other writers.
Yeah, in fact, when I say that I write that many, a number of them do, in recent years at least, tend to be collaborative. My wife and I work together under the joint pen name Barbara Allen, and we do a fairly successful series of cozy mysteries, very funny mysteries, about antiquing. Antiques Roadkill is the first title, and we've done, about 8 of those, and they're like I say, they're really quite successful, and they're very, very funny. My friend Matt Clemens and I work together on thrillers. Sometimes I'm able to give him a co-byline, and sometimes I have to just give him a credit inside the book. But he co-wrote all of the CSI novels. He co-wrote the Dark Angels. He co-wrote the Criminal Minds. And we did 2 books together for Kensington where he did get to use his name with mine. One of which was nominated for a Thriller Award by the Thriller, Best Paperback of the Year by the Thriller Authors, and that's called what are the names of those books? I have trouble remembering the names because they didn't use our titles, and I didn't like the titles they used.
Yeah.
But it's like, You Can't Stop Me, I think is the name of the first one.
Right, uh-huh.
And the second one was No One Will Hear You, and those are really fun. As fun as a serial killer book can be, I guess. So he does work with me on some things, and then of course I've been working with the Spillane Estate to complete a number of manuscripts that my mentor Mickey Spillane left behind, and this year Titan will be bringing out Complex 90, which will be the fifth of the Mike Hammer novels I've completed that Mickey left behind. Substantial manuscripts.
So he had a manuscript or an outline or something.
Yeah, in all cases, well, there's a lot of material here. He left a lot of material behind, but the books that I focused on first were these unfinished manuscripts where there'd be 100 or more pages. So these aren't just little notes or ideas, and that's why I consider them collaborations, because I expand them, I develop them, and complete them. So his 100 pages has turned into 300 pages by the end of the process.
We're chatting with Max Allen Collins, who's published quite a few novels in the Hard Case Crime series that we love, and I love them because they're not just great stories, but you know they are books, and they have these wonderful illustrations and on the cover, and
Yeah, the covers are almost always great.
Charles Ardai was with us a few weeks ago talking about the James M. Cain novel that he completed.
Yeah, I was tangentially involved in that.
Yes.
Because I cheerleaded that one into existence, I would say.
Your name came up in that conversation.
Yeah, God bless Charles. I mean, he's done so much for noir, hard-boiled mystery and detective fiction in the last, I don't know when it started now, about 5, 6, 7, 8 years. But what was interesting about that experience for me is that I was one of the authors that Charles wanted to reprint. He wanted to do Don Westlake, he wanted to do Lawrence Block, he had several people, and he came to me and he reprinted a couple things of mine. And finally I said to him, I'd rather do new books for you. And he said, well, I can't pay you any more to write a new book than I can to, because he has a very restricted budget. And, you know, so I'd have to pay you the same thing for a reprint that for a new book than I would for a reprint. And he just had assumed that I would rather take a book out of print book and get the money for it than to write a new one. And I said, no, I want to write some new books for you. And my thinking was, on the one hand, I would get to do some things that nobody else would let me do. And I also felt like it was this sort of young, hip, retro thing, because the new authors he was publishing tended to be young. I thought, I can come out there and get a new audience. Because they don't know how old I am. They just see the book. And I want them to, you know, I want to connect with them now with new material. And so I got to bring back my Quarry character, who is one of my favorite things that I do. Hadn't been able to regularly write about Quarry for like 25 years.
We were very excited to see Ms. Tree make a reappearance.
And we did one Ms. Tree book. That probably was the one that was the most, sort of controversial. Not everybody liked that. I mean, one of the things that happens with me at Hard Case is that I do use it as a place where, and Charles has been great to me, where he just basically said, what do you want to write this time? And so I've mixed it up a little bit. And so if you were reading Quarry, and I don't know if you've read the Quarry novels, but they're very, very hard-boiled. They're about as tough as it gets. And then when I did Ms. Tree, which is tough, but had a different tone, had a, you know, I hate to say this, but a comic booky tone, a little bit of a larger-than-life melodramatic tone. Some people didn't like that. It wasn't dark enough, you know.
Well, maybe they hadn't been Ms. Tree fans like I've been.
Well, they might not have been. And you know, and it's going to be very interesting to see how they respond to Seduction of the Innocent, because it is, you know, more like Rex Stout than Mickey Spillane.
It struck me, Seduction of the Innocent, which is, as we were saying earlier, you know, in the world of the blacklisting or the comic book scandals of the 1950s, it's also kind of like a Perry Mason episode where we meet all of the characters and then...
Oh, it's definitely an homage, a pastiche of the Golden Age mystery. Rex Stout, Ellery Queen, you know, as you say, Perry Mason. I'm a big Earl Stanley Gardner fan, and I've read all of the Perry Mason novels.
There's only 88 of them or something.
Yeah, no, I've read them all, and yeah. Everybody thinks... Because of what I write, and because I've been so associated with Mickey Spillane, and been such a proponent of Spillane and James M. Cain and Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, that's sort of the be-all and the end-all. But I'm also a huge fan of Rex Stout, Ellery Queen, Earl Stanley Gardner, and Agatha Christie. So I, you know, that's why some of the work I do, like the novels I do with my wife, fall into that kind of category of, you know, here's all the suspects, and, you know,
yes,
Charlie Chan.
There's the Agatha Christie aspect of Seduction of the Innocent also, in which all of the suspects are collected in the end.
Yeah.
We're not going to give away anything here, folks. But that's
one of the nice things about, again, doing it for Hard Case Crime, I had done two books in this series previously for Berkeley Prime Crime. And Berkeley Prime Crime was publishing primarily... you know, cozy mysteries, or what are sometimes called traditional mysteries, which is to say, not tough, not noir. And so when the first two books in this series, I was by far the toughest thing they'd ever published, but I still had to sort of hold back on the reins a little bit. But going to hard case crime with Seduction of the Innocent, I could let go a little bit in terms of the sex, the violence, and so on. So there's some rough stuff in here. I have that scene. There's a scene with a nude woman who's thrown down the stairs, for example.
I had to read that scene over and over again. I'm sure Frederick Wertheim would hate that scene.
Yeah, I don't know. You always suspect that the people who want to censor all this stuff are putting themselves in a position where they will have
a huge collection.
It's like, yeah, I'm the poor cop who has to look at all the pornography. It's a rough gig, you know.
Well, and Frederick Wertheim, of course, was a real person who wrote a real book called Seduction of the Innocent. And
right.
He doesn't appear in your book. There's a fictionalized version of him.
I've mentioned my Nathan Heller novels, and the Nathan Heller novels are all based on, Nathan Heller is a Chicago private detective in the 30s, 40s, and thereafter, a book called Target Lancer about the JFK assassination was published a couple of months ago in the Nate Heller series. And those books all are very historically accurate. They deal, most of the names are real, the dates, they really make an attempt to do the history in an accurate fashion within a certain amount of license you take because it's a fictional work. Whereas this novel, which features this detective Jack Starr, who's a comic book syndicate troubleshooter. Now that's the job I want, comic strip syndicate troubleshooter. Jack Starr is, he's working in a recognizably real world against a recognizably real historical landscape, but the names are changed. For example, Frederick Wertheim's character, who's called Dr. Werner Frederick, is murdered. He is the murder victim in this book, whereas in real life, a lot of people wanted to kill him in the comic book industry, but he hadn't been killed. And the three novels I've done have all dealt with aspects of the comic strip history, comic book and comic strip history, that I didn't think would really work that well in Nathan Heller. The first book, which is called A Killing in Comics, basically deals with Siegel and Shuster and how they got screwed out of Superman. And the second book, which was called Strip for Murder, had to do with the feud between Al Capp, the Little Abner creator, and Ham Fisher, the creator of the comic strip Joe Palooka, and how it wound up in the death of one of them. And this time, of course, we've got this fabulous landscape of the McCarthy era, where we can point at something that, because we always think of the McCarthy era, understandably, as a right-wing thing. But this is really left-wing. This is Wertheim is coming from the left and trying to save people through censorship. And I always say that the place where the far right and the far left meet is at a book burning. They sometimes are carrying different books, but they're throwing them onto the fire. So this is, it's odd because, again, mostly the McCarthy era is a right-wing phenomenon, but it shows you the tenor of the times. It shows you a certain hysteria that wasn't just strictly political. It was like something was in the air.
Just a few years after World War II, we're burning books. Comic books, but books. Some of my favorite.
And this is absolutely historically accurate, that there were all kinds of schools where the schools would brag about the fact that in their school parking lot, this would be on newsreels, that kids would be invited to bring their comic books and throw them in a big pile, and they would burn them in the school parking lot. How clueless can you be?
Don't they know those comics are worth a fortune now?
Well, there's that. Of course, you could argue that that's why they're worth a fortune. And
that's probably true. Well, it is a great book, and it also has some marvelous illustrations from your Ms. Tree partner, Terry Beatty.
Terry Beatty did a fantastic job. He's done illustrations for all three of these books, and what he does is he makes the style of the illustrations he does suit the topic. If you looked at Killing in Comics, the art kind of looks like Joe Shuster art. And if you look at Strip for Murder, it kind of looks like Al Cap, Little Abner. And in this one, it's very EC, even down to what they call Leroy lettering, that machine lettering. Looks somewhere between maybe it's Johnny Craig inked by Jack Davis or something.
He's the Rich Little of comic book art.
He does a great job on that. And, not to confuse people, but there's a piece of comic art at the beginning of every chapter. Every chapter is announced by a speech balloon. And then when you get toward the end of the book, before you get to the last chapter, you have the Ellery, well, this was done in Ellery Queen. It was particularly done on the Ellery Queen TV show with Jim Hutton.
Yeah.
The challenge to the reader, right. where you know, the detective goes over all the clues and the suspects and tries to give you a chance to figure things out before he actually reveals, the denouement of the mystery. And so that's done in comic book, comic strip fashion. There's literally, you're going to see that play out with speech balloons and so on.
Oh, the book is called Seduction of the Innocent, and it's a great addition to the Max Allen Collins Library. And it's really a pleasure to talk to you about it here on From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much, and I think people will enjoy this book, and the cover is worth the price of admission.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. I want to thank my guest, Max Allen Collins, his latest book from Hard Case Crime, Seduction of the Innocent. Check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can also find us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.